Is it on this time? Good, because I just recorded 7 minutes of audio with the audio on and absolutely no video, which probably goes to show how I am putting my mind well and truly into Christmas holiday mode and really not paying a whole lot of attention to anything else, which is good. I actually don't care having to re-record this when it's due to the fact that I'm actually trying to tune my brain out for a little bit. But be that as it may, let me recap the highlights of what I just spoke and didn't record. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about Christmas because, you know, obviously we've just gone through the Christmas period. The news and everything's a little bit slow. I haven't been writing much. There is one thing. But I know that for folks overseas looking at myself and other people down here in Australia, you'll probably look at us here at this time of year and go, well, isn't that weird? It's like everything's bizarro world back to front. Because it's warm down here in Australia, we don't have any snow, certainly this time of year, and, you know, we're still doing the Christmassy things. And it's kind of funny the way Christmas is in Australia. So obviously we have it at the same time of year, and we still have a lot of the European or Northern Hemisphere Christmassy style things, but in the heat. So, for example, I tweeted a photo when I was in one of our garden centres just before Christmas, where they got the decorations out, and we're in this garden centre and it's like 30-something degrees Celsius. This is not like the 30 degrees Fahrenheit where it's really, really cold. This is like the Celsius one where it's really, really hot. Incidentally, it's only the US and I think it's like Bermuda and Panama or a couple of other odd different places that actually use Fahrenheit anymore. So normally, when you see temperatures, they're Celsius, except if you're American. And anyway, let's not get started on the differences of measurements. Oh, man. Hear that? That's the ice cream van. We literally haven't... there you go. I was talking about summer, and the ice cream van literally just went past my window. I really hope the kids don't hear that. There's been a lot of ice cream this summer. So anyway, we're in the hardware store there in the garden center, and they've got Christmas decorations, which are things like snowflakes. So it's like stinking hot, everyone's sweating, and there's snowflakes hanging around. And there's snowmen, and there's Santa. And Santa's there in the same big red suit with all the fur, and this poor bastard is stinking hot, sweating, because he's trying to do the Christmassy Santa thing, but be in Australia where it's super, super hot. So this is kind of the paradox that is Australia, having Christmas at the same time of year, but just with completely opposite seasons. But for us, that means that our Christmases and our New Year's are always very warm. So it normally means that we're outdoors a lot. It'll be, you know, all of us spending time in the pool. I was going to say kids spending time in the pool, but let's not sugarcoat it. It's me as well, which is a really, really nice way to spend our days. We have very similar foods to sort of Northern Hemisphere, very traditional Christmas food. So we'll have, you know, turkeys and hams and things like that. But we'll have a lot of seafood too. So our Christmas dinner was literally prawns. Now, they're not shrimp, like the tiny little things that you see very often in the US, but they're like massive prawns. So we had a bunch of those, and it was a very hot day for us, Christmas Day. So where we're located is a spot called the Gold Coast, which is a subtropical part of Australia. We have often very hot days, around about 30 to 32 degrees Celsius. Very consistent temperature here, day by day. It doesn't change very much. And it'll be clear and it will be hot all day. And then you get to like 4 o'clock and you'll just have this massive storm roll in. It will dump rain. It'll sort of freshen everything up. It's still nice and warm outside. So Christmas Day, we spent at my brother's. And we're sitting outside at their place watching these massive storms roll in while we're drinking beer and, you know, doing the things that you should be doing on Christmas Day or any other day. So that was cool. And one of the other interesting things about this spot where we live, the Gold Coast is very much a holiday destination for Australia, but it's also the sixth largest city in the country. Now, it's not sort of Melbourne or Sydney size. Those cities have about 4.5 million people each. We have about 600,000 people in the city. So it's a reasonable size. We've got everything we need, but it's not a big metropolis. So we're here on the Gold Coast, and one of the really interesting things about the Gold Coast is that we have more canals here, so more waterways, than Amsterdam and Venice combined. And if you've been to Amsterdam or Venice, you'll know that there are a lot of canals there. And I'm checking my stats here because I went and fact-checked myself before I recorded this. We've got 400 kilometers of canals and another 160 kilometers of channels. Now, I'm not entirely sure what the difference between a canal and a channel is. I just know it's a lot of water. So as a result, we literally have tens of thousands of houses on the Gold Coast that are waterfront, and ours is one of those. So one of the things that we did after we moved in here a couple of years ago, and many of you have seen these photos, is we got a jet ski, which is cool because we could put the jet ski under the house and then put it in the water and then zip around, you know, canals or channels or whatever. And this was a great way of being outdoors and seeing the sights here. And then for Christmas, we decided to get ourselves a boat. So we finally have a boat now, which was a big decision, I guess, both sort of financially and logistically, because now there is another thing to look after and to maintain. But the boat was really cool in terms of the opportunities it opens up, because now it's easy for the whole family to go out. It is kind of, it was kind of funny to see like my wife and I and the two kids on a jet ski. And it's a little bit like if ever you've been to Southeast Asia, let's say you've been to Indonesia or somewhere like that, and it's like mum and dad and two kids all on a motorbike and they're jammed in there, zipping around the streets. It kind of felt a little bit like that on the jet ski. So now we've actually got room. And the other thing is that's great for when we have people come and visit. So even this morning, I had some friends come and visit from interstate. We get a lot of people from overseas visitors here. And it's awesome because now you can actually all go out with some degree of comfort and see the sights. So that's a new thing, and that will be something that I share in bits and pieces over the coming months and years. So New Year's. New Year's is probably going to be very similar in that it'll be hot, we'll be outdoors. Actually going to go and watch the tennis at the Brisbane International on New Year's Day, or actually the December 31. So that would be kind of cool. And then that evening, I don't know if it's nice weather, maybe we'll do a bit of cruising on the boat out towards where the fireworks and things are. Otherwise, we're going to be laying at home relaxing. But it will be hot and sunny until it gets dark. And that's the way it is in Australia this time of year. All right, now, a few other things. And there is something I wrote about I want to talk about, but I just had an idea earlier today. And I thought whilst it's sort of in my mind, I'd talk about it here. Because some people might pop up and go, hey, someone's already done this, or here's something that you might like to consider with it. And the idea I had, in fact, I thought about this yesterday, and then I had a chat with my mate Scott Helm today, which just kind of drove this home, is that disclosure of data breaches or disclosure of security incidents, even just vulnerabilities, let's say you've got a SQL injection vulnerability somewhere, is hard and painful, and I've written about lots of things to try and make that easier from the company's perspective. So, yeah, for example, last week I wrote about fixing data breaches, and one of the things was make disclosure easy, use a security.txt file, things like that. But one of the things I was thinking about is I wonder if we should have a sort of a broadly agreed upon structure of how to do disclosure in terms of, for example, try and find a contact us page, try and find who is information on domain records, try social media accounts. You know, like what is the accepted, here is how to get in touch with the company, and then here is how to escalate it if you can't. And the relevance to Scott, who I just mentioned, is he pinged me today and he's found some nasty stuff with an organization that really, really does not want to have nasty stuff. And he's saying, look, I can't find any contact information on their site. Their Twitter account doesn't accept DMs. I could tweet to them, but as soon as someone like he or I go and tweet to a company and say, hey, do you have a security contact? It's kind of like that is escalation. And there's a point where it should happen. But what I'd love to do is it's almost like have a flowchart. You know, like start here. Do they have a published security page? You know, like I mentioned last week in my Fixing Data Breaches series, Tesla has a security vulnerability reporting policy. Do they have that? Almost certainly no. Do they have security TXT? Almost certainly no. Do they have a contact page? Yes, try that. And then if no response within X number of days, then do this or do that. And I guess what I'm thinking here is that if there was a process that you're never going to get consensus of, But if it was a process that most people agreed is the best thing to do under the circumstances, people like myself, and perhaps you as well if you find something, would feel much more comfortable following that because there's a structure. And you know that people have endorsed this and agreed, you know, smart people within the industry have agreed that this is a good way to do it. If you know of something like that already, if you know of a good structure, let me know. If you have thoughts about this, let me know. I don't know what this will turn into, but it might be a little blog post. It might be something more formal. But I would really like to come up with a way that we can agree to do this better than what we're doing it at the moment. Because at the moment, we're just sort of winging it. All right, so that's that. Let me talk about what I have actually written about this week, which is a new Pluralsight course. Now this, I think, is actually my 33rd Pluralsight course I worked out. And this is actually on something that I don't know particularly well. And the reason why I'm doing it is because I'm playing the straight man, for want of a better term, whilst my mate Oren Thomas, who actually knows what he's doing in this particular realm, plays the subject matter expert. So this course is called Play-by-Play Care and Maintenance of Development VMs. And Oren Thomas is a fellow Microsoft MVP, that's these things up here, and also a fellow Microsoft Regional Director. And he is an exceptionally smart bloke who specializes in more the IT pro side of the industry. So a lot of server management and configuration sort of stuff. And he's written, I said in the blog post, like insert crazy large number here, of books. And it's something like 30 plus books or something the guy's written. He's just a machine, churns them out, you know, nonstop. And he's very, very good at this sort of stuff. Very good speaker as well, if ever you get a chance to see Oren. And we teamed up to do this play-by-play where I sort of know enough about VMs to have a vague idea of what I'm talking about. And he actually knows how to manage them properly. So we spent a lot of time talking about how to use VMs and in particular Hyper-V within Windows to aid development processes. And just looking through some of the things here that have been captured in the play-by-play, a bit of stuff here about why should we actually use VMs as developers? Like, what value proposition does it give us? And to be honest, I think some of this is a bit contentious. I use them for certain purposes, which are not always consistent with what an IT pro thinks that developers should use them for. We talk a lot about improving VM processes, desktop switching. I wasn't doing desktop switching as well as I could. And if desktop switching is a foreign term to you, definitely worth checking that out, regardless of VMs as well, by the way. Checkpoints, rebuilding VMs with Chocolaty. Now, Chocolaty is something that I've used for quite some time. And if you've not heard of Chocolaty before as a means of automatically installing a whole bunch of applications in a brand new machine, go and check that out. Because it makes it really easy to say, look, here's my batch, if you like, of different apps that I want installed on my machine. Give me a new machine, run Chocolaty, let downloads happen and magic and everything happen. Job done. So that was kind of cool. Connecting VMs to wireless networks, I always find I have trouble, particularly with the machine there, the Lenovo with multiple NICs on it, getting virtual machines properly connected to networks and getting access from the host and so on and so forth. So Oren talks a bunch about that, and I ask him questions, which I think are the sorts of questions most of you would ask if you're from a development background. Enhanced session mode, which is kind of neat, getting data into isolated virtual machines, a couple little tricks there that I wasn't aware of as well. And that is about it. And we've got a 49-minute course there in play-by-play format, which means I'm here, ice cream truck. Oh man, now I'm feeling like ice cream. We're in a cul-de-sac. So every time the ice cream truck goes that way, you know it has to come back that way again as well. Anywho, it is play-by-play. So it's him and I sitting here in a very casual chat kind of mode. And what's nice about these is they're great to watch if you're on the train on the way to work or you've got some time at lunch, because it's not overly mentally taxing and they're quite short in terms of their duration. And the feedback on that's been really good. Looking at the ratings, they're coming back very, very well as well. I think I can only see 4.5 out of 5 stars. I don't know if it's 4.6 or 4.3. It's going well. We're happy with it. So that was the Pluralsight course. Now, last thing I thought I'd talk about is my sponsor for this week. And I thought, given that I didn't have a lot of stuff on, I'd talk a bit more about this sponsor, because NetSparker, who's the sponsor, is an organization and indeed a product that I've been using for many, many years now. And the reason this machine is open behind me is because I've got some stuff running on there that I thought I'd sort of walk through. So NetSparker creates dynamic analysis security software. And for those of you that are not familiar with the term, and I'm aware I've got a broad audience that listens to this or watches this, the whole sort of premise of dynamic analysis is this is running tests against a live running application. So for example, in the context of a web application, it's a website, and you take the dynamic analysis tool, and you point it at a URL and you tell it to go. And it crawls around there and it discovers and it probes and it finds all sorts of things. And what I thought I'd do, it's running on this machine at the moment. I'm going to pick it up and read you through some of the things just to try and give you a sense of what you can get out of dynamic analysis. Now also, just for the sake of transparency and everything, this is not like some sponsored paid extra NetSparker expose. It is just a normal weekly blog sponsorship. But I didn't have a lot of stuff on this week, and this is genuinely a tool that I use very frequently. So I show NetSparker in all of my workshops. I've written about NetSparker for many years now, around things like integrating it into continuous analysis or continuous integration, so that every time you do, say, a nightly build and a release into a test environment, you follow that up with dynamic analysis and you get a report in your security profile. I'm running this report in front of me on hackyourselffirst.troyhunt.com, which is a website that I built as part of my workshops. So every time I go and run, well, actually, I'll go back a little bit. I built this originally as part of my second ever Pluralsight course called Hack Yourself First, How to Go on the Cyber Offense. I know, cyber, sorry. And I used it in multiple other courses, and I use it in my workshops. And it's got 50 plus pretty serious security vulnerabilities in there. And what I like doing is using tools like NetSparker to try and show how far we can automate security analysis. So for example, in my workshops, the very last thing I do, end of day two, is I go, okay, we've just learned all about things like, let's say, HTTP-only cookies. You know, HTTP-only cookies are important because if it's flagged HTTP-only and someone gets XSS on your site, then they can't read it via client script. Now that you know what they do, let's not waste valuable human time with you guys continually trying to find cookies that aren't flagged appropriately, because that does cost the humans money and time, and you can automate this stuff. So where I really like to finish is let's look at how much of what we've just done we can now automate. So you know the mechanics of it now, you know why it's a problem, let the machines go and do what they do best. So I have pointed at hackyourselffirst.troyhunt.com. I'm going to publish this report, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes for this week's podcast, vodcast, whatever. So you can go and have a look at what it finds. But where we're at the moment is it's finding a whole bunch of different SQL injection problems. All of these tools, incidentally, will give you severity ratings. So at the moment, I've got 5 critical findings. I've got Boolean-based SQL injection. I've got SQL injection itself on another page. The reasons I really like NetSparker, and one of the reasons I started using it so extensively, is because the feedback you get is very consumable by normal everyday people. Now, I guess let's actually put some shape around that. What I mean by that is it's consumable by normal everyday software developers. And in fact, one of the reasons I really got involved in it to begin with is that in my old job, I would see reports come back from a security team, and the reports would be very, very security people centric. And one thing I continually find, in fact, I mentioned this in a Pluralsight thing that's going to come out next month, is that the way security folks tend to communicate is often very different to the way development folks tend to communicate. This is why I got so involved in security to begin with, actually. And I'd see some particular tools generate reports with so many acronyms and abstract terms to the people that were actually responsible for fixing them that they'd have a lot of trouble doing anything. And developers would get these reports and they'd look at it and go, I got no idea. Like, I don't understand why this is a problem. I don't understand the actions to reproduce it. I don't understand how it's exploitable, and I don't understand how to fix it. And what I really like about NetSparker is it puts it in very readily consumable terms. So I'm looking at the SQL injection report here, and it's like, here is the URL where there's a vulnerability. And I can click on this URL, and it opens up in the browser, and I get a yellow screen of death, an internal SQL client .SQL exception, so I know that it's the exception being raised in the database, and it's effectively a proof that there is a SQL injection vulnerability. And then it says, hey, here's the database version. It sucks that out via SQL injection. Here's the name of the database. Here's the identity of the user that's connecting to the database from the web app. And here are details of the vulnerability, the impact, the actions to take, the remedy, and all of this is in human-readable format. And then we've got things like PCI references in terms of where you'd be violating various PCI objectives. We've got the OWASP references, CWEs, all sorts of things if you want to try and relate it back to industry standards. So look, obviously SQL injection is the sort of nasty stuff that we'll find. We've got things like passwords transmitted over HTTP. We've got things like a critical form served over HTTP. So which form is that? Yeah, the login form. Okay, obviously don't serve your login pages over HTTP. Here's a good one. There is a Git repository in the root of this website. So I literally have published a Git repository to the root of hackyourselffirst.troyhunt.com. And I know that sounds stupid, but there are a lot of websites out there that do it. Because someone's built their site and they've got their Git repository at the root of their site, and then they've just FTP'd the whole thing up, repository and all, and then your repository ends up with credentials and stuff in it. And it's just, it's not a good day when that happens. Other things as well, insecure transport security protocol supported. So I'm supporting TLS 1.0 on this site, and they're saying, hey, look, you really don't want to have that anymore because it's vulnerable to things like the Beast attack. And also, websites using TLS 1.0 will be considered non-compliant by PCI after 30 June 2018. And it just goes on and on and on and on. This is still running. It's made just over 10,000 requests at the moment. It's going to do a heap more than that before the whole thing finishes. And it's just a really great way of getting a good visual snapshot of the security position of your application. Now, this particular scan I have set up to authenticate into the system as well. So you don't have to just scan a publicly facing system. You can say, look, there are anything from forms-based authentication to basic auth in order to access other resources. You go through and sort of map the login process, which takes, it took me 30 seconds. And it can then log in and test things behind an authenticated interface as well. So I went through and configured that. So when this report is generated, I will see reports for things that only authenticated users can see, which is kind of neat. So have a good look at that and just have a think, like in your development process, do you have any automation? And if you don't, you really want to think about it because humans are expensive. Software, by comparison, is cheap. And it's going to find a bunch of stuff that humans won't find anywhere. Anyway, so somewhere in your process, whether it's NetSpark or other automated products like that, you definitely want to have these things in there. So hopefully that gives you something a little bit interesting beyond the scope of what I've just written about this week. And hopefully that little bit of an insight into what Christmas is like down here as well is kind of interesting. Next week, we'll actually be in 2018. We'll be back into a quasi-normal routine, I guess. And in fact, by the time I come to you next week, I'll only have about another week at home before I've got to go somewhere cold again as well, which is a bit sad, but it won't be for a long time. So I won't be away for a long time. I guess that's it for this week. Thank you very much for watching. I hope everyone is actually doing some things with their family and maybe not spending their time watching my updates videos. So I would actually like to see my numbers a bit lower this week. And if you have watched, thank you very much. And I hope everyone has an awesome time for the new year coming. And I'll come to you next week. See you guys.